Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and how the tech are ya? It's time for a Tech Stuff Classic episode. We are actually going to continue the conversation that was begun in last week's Classic episode. Last week was the Manhattan Project Part 1. This week, it's Tech Stuff Takes Manhattan Project. Ben Bolin joins us yet again to chat about the Manhattan Project, and I hope you enjoy.
So I'd like to say to all listeners, if you have not heard Part 1 of this podcast or this series, then I implore you. Maybe that's too strong a word. I don't know.
No, I think implore is a good word.
Because otherwise, there are going to be a lot of players. It's going to be like watching season 4 of Lost.
Yeah.
Without having seen anything
else. It'll be like if you've heard, hey, that Game of Thrones show is supposed to be really good.
Right, yeah.
Let me just watch this one episode. You won't know who any of the people are or why they're doing what they're doing. So here's a quick previously on Tech Stuff. We ended up covering the physics that led up to the discovery of fission. We also covered the political landscape, the fact that World War II was, the world was building up to World War II, and then World War II breaks out, and how that ended up creating a fast track in the United States for research into fission, specifically in the weaponization of fission, using atomic science to create a weapon, because there was the very real threat that the Nazis were working on their own program for such a thing. And even before the United States was pulled into the war, there was this need. Einstein himself had expressed concern. And we also talked about sort of the players that were all doing various lines of research into the separation of ions of uranium, because as it turns out, U-235 is really what you want if you're trying to achieve nuclear fission, especially a sustainable chain reaction. But U-238 is overwhelmingly the more abundant version of uranium that's found in nature. And separating the two is not an easy task. So we have multiple areas of research looking into ways to do that, and also a need to find a way to weaponize it. We concluded part one. This is just to set us up for part two.
Right, yeah.
We concluded part one talking about how there was the Army Corps of Engineers had become involved, and there was a fellow named James C. Marshall who was initially in charge. James C. Marshall's headquarters were located in Manhattan, mm-hmm. and specifically was the Manhattan Energy District was the code name for it. And the secret project, super secret project, to develop atomic weapons became known as the Manhattan Project, even after those headquarters were no longer in Manhattan.
Yeah, you know, if you find a name that works, you stick with the name. And it's one of those common misconceptions, because as we've mentioned on the previous episode, this Manhattan Project did not occur, not only did it not occur in just Manhattan or just New Mexico, but it occurred in areas across the U.S. There's some really cool stuff that's going to happen.
There are towns that only exist because of the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. They would not have otherwise grown up where they are. And to really get into this, at this stage, the very early days of the Manhattan Project, as an official thing, there were some tensions that were already building up between the scientific community, the various research centers that were looking into this, and the Army that was more or less kind of facilitating it, you know, sort of in charge, but also mainly their purpose was to make sure that the scientists were going to have the facilities and resources that they would need in order to do what they needed to do.
And also the ones to crack the whip on the timeline.
Yeah. Well, and as it turns out, the Army moves at a certain pace that the scientists didn't find particularly helpful. The essentially bureaucracy got in the way. Things slowed down, and the scientists were not entirely happy with the way Marshall was running things. So in September 1942, the Army decides to replace Marshall with Colonel Leslie R. Groves, who, after, you know, 6 days after becoming the head of the Manhattan Project, was promoted to Brigadier General. So calling him Colonel Groves is misleading, since he was almost immediately a brigadier general. Groves was instrumental in bringing the Pentagon, or building the Pentagon. He was one of the people very much in charge of that project, and he also had a background as an engineer, so he understood the needs of building facilities, you know, what actually is required to do this, and he knew how to work on this in a very aggressive timeline, I guess is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. So Groves moves in, and then there were all these different sites that the scientists had identified as being potentially ideal for the Manhattan Project, and Marshall had been very slowly investigating them. Groves, on the other hand, said, all right, let's do it.
Let's
get her done. So Groves relocated the headquarters from Manhattan to D.C., but of course, it was already known as the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. It was not going to be called the D.C. Project. It got stuck that way. And he made Colonel Kenneth D. Nichols, who was James C. Marshall's deputy, into his chief aide on the project. Marshall himself became a district engineer within the program, and that's where he really excelled within the Manhattan Project, because his talents were considerable. It's just they were better suited for a different job than overseeing the entire project.
Right. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, because as it turns out, you know, you want someone who's aggressive so that things can get started, but you also want people who observe the need for caution when you're handling nuclear materials.
Right. Yeah, it's important to know Marshall was not fired.
No, he was just simply reassigned. It was one of those things where the need for this project was clear. Mm-hmm. But how to organize it was something that was kind of up in the air for a little bit.
It's the first time anybody was doing something like this, as far as we knew.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, the ancient Egyptians know. So at the same time that this is going on, Vannevar Bush, if you don't know who that is, you need to listen to our last episode.
We told you.
Yeah, it's just going to get more difficult from this point forward. set up the Military Policy Committee, which would be made up of a representative from the Army, a representative from the Navy, and one from the Office of Scientific Research and Development. If you recall, Bush himself was the head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, but was constantly moving up because his considerable talents in also getting things done. Bush, I think, was probably one of the best at figuring out who would be ideal to run certain parts of this project. Like, he was really good at matching the people with the parts of the project that needed them. Visionary kind of guy.
Well, also very, very effective at being a liaison between the big machine and then these brilliant scientists.
He seemed to know how to handle people no matter what background they came from. Mm-hmm. And those folks are invaluable. I mean, you can find people who are really smart and really talented, but if they don't know how to interact with other people, they don't go very far. Bush, however, was not one of those guys.
We'll be back with more of this classic episode of Tech Stuff after this quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue, real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class exclusive Google built-in is your always updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Groves himself made it clear that the pursuit of multiple lines of research for that isotope separation, that was something that could not go on forever. That really what needed to happen was the project needed to settle on the, you know, one line or maybe two lines of inquiry
right.
to really concentrate their efforts. Even if it turned out those were not the most efficient, it would mean that they could at least concentrate their workforce.
Right, because at the time, these scientists have their pet projects.
Yeah.
Which some of them have, even if they, some of them already kind of indicate that this will be enormously expensive unless
right.
there's some breakthrough.
And you had groups that had very different views on the efficacy
yes.
of the various methodologies. For example, the British loved the idea of gaseous diffusion for mm-hmm. isotope separation. Meanwhile, you have Oppenheimer, who was demonstrating that the electromagnetic version of isotope separation could be incredibly effective. It's just that he was working on a smaller scale.
Right.
Right. But the scale that he was working on, if he could scale up, he was pretty sure this methodology would be incredibly fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So he was arguing quite strongly for that. So you had all these different camps coming in, and then you had other versions as well. Those
right.
were just two of them. And that's what Groves was saying. Okay, guys, really, by the end of this year, by the end of 1942, let's really settle on a specific one
mm-hmm.
so that we can actually make a weapon that will make a difference in this war, because at the rate we're going,
mm-hmm.
by the time we create a weapon, peace will have broken out and then we'll just feel like jackasses.
Or it would be a situation where if we don't get there, someone is going to, because the paranoia
yeah.
at that time was so very high. You
right.
know?
Even, first of all, there was not really any... There was no way of knowing what was going on in the Nazi
mm-hmm.
camps. So it could very well be that Nazi scientists were much closer. There,
right.
That was a legitimate fear. But beyond that, there were already tensions between the United States and other nations, specifically
sure.
the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was also a real fear that the Soviet Union could be investigating this as well. And so even if the weapon weren't used in World War II, it would be really important for the United States' interests, for there to be such a weapon, period. In fact, that's going to play a part when we get to the point of actually deploying said weapon. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, November 1942, there was one of the methods of isotope separation that just did not pan out, and that was using centrifuges.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the centrifuge machines were not dependable. They
right.
would break down too frequently. So it wasn't that the methodology was bad. It was that the machinery itself was not dependable.
It was the tech issue.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you remember the Stuxnet story,
mm-hmm.
you know, those were centrifuges that were set to spin at the wrong speed, which ended up causing some pretty
yeah.
big issues.
It broke down. Yeah.
yeah. So, you know, it's something that we've known about for since the 1940s, is that if you don't get the machinery to work correctly, then you're not going to be producing the U-235 that you need.
Mm-hmm.
So electromagnetic separation was the big winner so far with U-235. Gas diffusion was promising enough to still be in the running for consideration, and the Brits were still very much behind that. Plutonium, which was a completely separate line of inquiry. Remember, most of this was focused on uranium. Plutonium was ended up getting a big boost as well. The Metallurgical Laboratory in Chicago, which had just recently brought Enrico Fermi on. He had been working at Columbia, and he had moved over to the Metallurgical Laboratory in Chicago. They produced a small amount of pure plutonium. They had uranium piles, and plutonium was a byproduct of the process they were using. And so they were saying, well, plutonium is a better, it's more apt to undergo fission than
mm-hmm.
U-235 is. The problem is making enough plutonium for that to be effective. So it was promising, but when we're talking small amount of pure plutonium, it's microscopic. That's
mm-hmm.
how small. So not useful for any sort of
anything.
Practical.
Yeah,
yeah. Nothing. Nothing at all. Except for the fact that saying, we've proven that it works.
Right, proven
right?
concept.
So if we can scale this up, then it could be a promising means of generating plutonium. And it was Glenn Seaborg's team. If you don't know who Seaborg is, you need to listen to the last episode.
Oh,
it figured out how to separate the plutonium from irradiated uranium. And then you had the theoretical physicists. So these are the guys who, you know, you had the experimental ones who were actually making theory, you know, putting theory to the test. But the theoretical physicists, who were led by Oppenheimer, were refining their calculations to figure out exactly how much fissionable material would be needed to create a working bomb. Now, the Brits had come forward and said probably between 5 to 10 kilograms. After they work with Oppenheimer and the other theorists, they said, yeah, we think that might be an underestimation. You might need twice as much. By the way, they would change this again later on, and each time the goalposts were moved further out. But we're going to need more material based on our calculations to make a truly reactive system where there is a sustainable chain reaction. So Oppenheimer was recommending research into a fusion bomb, not just fission. A fusion bomb would actually be triggered by initially a fission reaction. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to have fissionable material first, and then you would, the energy from that interaction would provide the necessary energy to facilitate a fusion reaction, which could be much more powerful. This would be the super bomb. A hydrogen bomb was one of those things that was bandied about quite a bit in these early days, but frankly, everyone's like, let's crack fission first.
Right. Finish your breakfast.
Yeah, exactly. But S1, the Office of Science and Research, authorized some research into light materials, deuterium being the main one, to look into the possibility of a fusion bomb. So they didn't want to discount it or dismiss it, but they also didn't want to put all the eggs in the fusion basket.
Right. Well, it's, you know, if you consider just from what you outlined earlier, it's complicating a process that we have yet to successfully do, you know, or complete.
Right. And so then Groves decides, okay, centrifuge is out. That's not going to work. It'll take us too long to refine the process for it to be practical. Let's focus right now on the pile research. That's what generates plutonium, the electromagnetic research, and the gaseous diffusion research. And we're going to skip the pilot plant stage, go straight to full-scale production. In other words, normally you would create a slightly larger pilot plant to make certain that the things you had tested in the laboratory still work at the plant stage. But if they don't work, then you can tweak things because the pilot plant isn't so large or so, the infrastructure is not so rigid that you can't shift things around. So the idea being that you find the ideal operating conditions at the pilot plant stage, then you scale up to full scale. They're skipping pilot plant and saying, we don't have time for it.
Which is a dangerous step to skip.
Yeah, literally and figuratively, right? Because figuratively, you could say, well, we built this facility based upon our best estimation, and it turns out that was off. And now we're stuck with it, and we have to use an unideal situation to do whatever it is we need to do. Literally, you're dealing with radioactive material.
Right.
And if it gets out of control, that would be devastating. December 2nd, 1942, Enrico Fermi and his team demonstrate in front of a group of dignitaries a nuclear chain reaction, which lasted for 28 minutes until Fermi shut it down. So that was this is where we get one of the most famous exchanges from the Manhattan Project. And it was when Compton, who called Conant, those names will be familiar. Compton called Conant, and they had the following exchange. Who do you want to be? Do you want to be Compton or Conant?
You know what? I'll be Compton if you're cool with it.
Go ahead.
Ring, ring.
Hello.
The Italian navigator has landed in the New World.
How were the natives?
Very friendly.
And that was the way of describing, not only was the experiment a success, but it impressed the dignitaries who were there to see it. So that was their improvised way of saying what had happened without, you know, squeeing or dropping information that might be pretty sensitive over a telephone line.
No, you did a you did a bang up job with these notes, and when I first saw this, it made me want to go into a rabbit hole of finding all of the recorded code word conversations of this time, because it must sound so bizarre, because people are saying it with gravity, but they're saying stuff like the rabbit has left the hutch.
Right.
The rabbit has left the hutch. And then the person on the other line is like, green? And someone goes, blue. And hangs up, you know?
Right. And you're like, does there any record of what this actually meant? I mean, probably the most famous quote out of all of the Manhattan Project, I would argue, comes from Oppenheimer.
Absolutely. And spawned so many things, ranging from out-and-out conspiracy theories to just fascinating biographies.
Yeah, to spoil it, because, I mean, I'll forget by the time we get around to the part where the bomb is being tested. Oppenheimer's famous quote, and you've probably heard it before, is, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
Yeah, and he has a quotation where he explains that, because that's some ominous stuff.
Yeah,
to
that's like a Nick Cave and the Bad Seed song.
It sure is.
It's right up there with Red Right Hand.
If I were just hanging out, if you and I were hanging out, when the bomb dropped and someone said that, they would immediately become a dangerous person. I would seriously wonder, like, well, should we have you around?
Yeah, for a moment, I thought you were going to say, like, if we were out and I just turned to you and said, "Hey, Jonathan, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," I would take that as something to really mull over and possibly start to look for the nearest exit.
Especially if we were just going down the street to a food truck or something.
Right, yeah, we're just heading out to the one over in the parking lot.
Yeah, talk about tooting your own horn. But there is a context to this, so
yeah,
and we can shed that light later.
We'll get there a little bit later.
We've got more to say in this classic episode of Tech Stuff after these quick messages.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road, into the wild, true blue, real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On December 28, 1942, the U.S. government allocated $500 million, which would eventually grow to more than $2 billion, 1942 dollars, to fund further development. By the way, those costs, that's just the official numbers. There could be tons and tons that are tied into it in one way or another. And not to mention funds that didn't come directly from the United States government.
Right. And that's a huge part of this. The truth of the matter is that we probably will never know for sure.
Yeah.
But we do know that $2 billion, although it may be the sticker price,
right,
was not the entirety of it.
Yeah. And in fact, when we say we may never know, no one might know, right? It's one
right.
of those, it's such a huge undertaking that it's very unlikely there's a document anywhere that has the full tally.
Right.
It's just too big. It's too big.
Yeah. So it's not like a conspiracy as much as it is a tremendously difficult calculation.
Exactly.
I've got the inflation number too there.
What's that?
And so we said $2 billion in 1942.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So let me just do some math here. Let me get my abacus out. And $2 billion, you have to use smaller values. I was on a calculator. And we have to use, it says you have to use smaller values. So just a lot of money. We'll leave it at
okay.
that.
Okay. a significant amount of cash. So the money went on to establish full-scale gaseous diffusion plants, full-scale plutonium plants, and smaller electromagnetic plants. Power plants, you know, like manufacturing facilities, not like biological plants.
Yeah. That doesn't come along until much later.
Yes. And Vannevar Bush said the earliest a bomb could be expected would be early 1945. And he was actually trying to be a little conservative because the earlier reports had suggested that if things worked out, there might be a weapon ready as early as 1944.
Right.
But Bush was thinking, you know, I'm going to pad that out a little bit. And as it turns out, even that was optimistic.
Yeah.
Early 1945 was a little optimistic. Plutonium was looking promising, but people were worried that the radioactive pile approach, which is what Fermi was using, wasn't going to be scalable. They'd be able to produce plutonium, but it would be at such small amounts that it would take way too long to have enough for it to be a weapon.
Especially considering that they want to build more than one because they have to test it.
Yeah.
And they're still not absolutely sure how much they need per weapon.
Right. And the demonstrations Fermi had shown revealed that there could be a chain reaction, but the reaction was at too slow a rate for it to be used potentially as a weapon. The idea being that, yeah, you could do this to generate energy, like it could be a nuclear power plant. The chain reaction would allow you to harness it in that respect, but it wouldn't be so fast to create an explosive event. Mm-hmm. So it would not be useful as a weapon. However, more research would go into that. Also, Fermi's approach was at such a slow rate of energy release that they did not need any sort of cooling system.
Yeah.
So there was no need for the very advanced cooling systems that you will find in nuclear power plants these days, which was kind of interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
There were three different competing designs for nuclear piles. One was a water-cooled model, which was developed by Gail Young and Eugene Wigner. One was a liquid metal cooled approach headed by our good friend Leo.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to the last episode. And the last was a helium cooled pile, which was headed by Thomas V. Moore, who was an engineer.
And this one is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it had a great nickname. It was called May West. presumably because the design included spherical segments in the outer shell of the facility. And Mae West was built.
Yes.
I don't mean the actress. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do mean the actress, but I really mean the actual facility nicknamed Mae West. That was not its official name, by the way.
What scale?
Yeah, right. So Groves demanded that the metallurgical lab come up with a unified approach. He wasn't going to say, all right, look, let's have all three of these progress at the same time.
Right.
Because he was already dealing with a branch further up, right? He was saying plutonium is just one of the legs of research they're already funding, the other two being electromagnetic and gaseous diffusion. So he didn't want plutonium research to then split into three separate groups as well. That would just become unmanageable. So a small facility would be headed by Fermi and shut down in 1943. So Fermi's research could end up informing the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
They would then be able to decide if that was in fact the way they wanted to go. Plus, they could take all the plutonium that was made by that's part of the research and set that aside. Mae West would be built and ready for operation by March 1944, and its design would allow it to produce 100 grams of plutonium per day, which was significantly more than Fermi's approach.
Yes. Yeah.
And good old Leo was allowed to continue research on liquid metal cooling systems kind of on his own.
Right. So, because it wasn't as big of a priority for a lot of the other things.
Yeah, it didn't look as promising to Groves. And so even though Groves was like, look, you have to settle on one, technically all three continued.
Yeah.
Again, they didn't want to draw any conclusions too early on, and it turned out that they backed the wrong horse.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Glenn Seaborg's work in plutonium extraction made it possible to separate plutonium from irradiated uranium, which was an important step because both plutonium and irradiated uranium were byproducts of this pile research. And you have to separate the two if you want to get the fissionable material necessary to create the chain reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So S1 felt that the plutonium experiments could potentially be dangerous. And so they were thinking maybe we should start separating out some of these facilities. Like maybe we shouldn't co-locate the plutonium separation facility with the nuclear pile facility.
Now, go back to your basket phrase. Why do we need to keep all our disasters in one basket?
Yeah.
And then this also, you know, needs to be in an unpopulated area.
Yes, because if you recall from the first episode, the nuclear pile research was largely taking place in an old racket court underneath the grandstand at the University of Chicago. So not, you know, the facility or the department actually was saying, yeah, we kind of wish you had come to us before you decided to use that area because this is kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
So they started looking around for potential partners to help build the facility, and there was one specifically that they looked at, and they required a lot of, coercion's the wrong word, but convincing for them to take part in it. It was DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
And DuPont was not super keen on doing this. It actually did take quite a few conversations before they came on board, but they would ultimately build the facility. And also in 1942, Oppenheimer suggested the location of Los Alamos, New Mexico, as one of the three sites the Manhattan Project would use to pursue the effort of building an atomic bomb. Very remote location. Oppenheimer himself owned a ranch that was neighboring Los Alamos.
Yeah.
So he thought of it as being remote enough for it to be a useful test site and development site. Also, there were very few people who were there, and the ones who were there could be convinced to move by offering them a decent amount of money for their land.
Especially considering that the value of the land at the time was pretty low because, what's out there?
Very little. Yeah, there was a boys' school that was out there, but Groves went up and offered to buy it from the school, offered to buy the land, and they said, all right, we'll relocate, and they left. So in 1943 in Eastern Tennessee, work was well underway, on several facilities. There was the plutonium plant that was designated X-10. There was the electromagnetic facility, which was Y-12, and a gaseous diffusion plant, which was called K-25. And this was a site that was located west of Knoxville, Tennessee. It was 90 square miles or 59,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a military reservation with the official name of Clinton Engineer Works. By the summer of 1943, the Manhattan Project headquarters would move from Washington to this site in Tennessee. And eventually that military site grew into a full-fledged town that today is called Oak Ridge.
Got a little tangent for you here.
What's
Jonathan.
That?
So my extended family is from the Tri-Cities area, which is in the very, very tip of Tennessee, mm-hmm. up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And for a time, members of my family lived and worked around the area that would be known as Oak Ridge. And it was sort of an open secret that something was going on, but people really didn't have any idea how big Oak Ridge would actually become, to the point where I think at some point it was providing power to a 1/7 of the power.
It was actually drawing 1/7 of the power.
Drawing the power. Yeah, that's
1/7
right.
of the power of the entire country, not of Tennessee.
Yeah.
Of the entire United States, 1/7 of the power being mm-hmm. generated in the United States was dedicated to powering the facilities at what would become Oak Ridge. That it was never called Oak Ridge during the duration of the Manhattan Project.
No.
That would come later. But eventually it did grow into a full-fledged town because mm-hmm. these projects were enormous and needed a huge variety of workers to mm-hmm. make things run. Everything from administrative staff to the people who actually operated the machinery and the controls,
mm-hmm.
the people who were transporting materials. There was support staff to support all of that. It quickly grew into a full-fledged town.
Yeah.
And so this was, and a lot of people didn't know what they were working on beyond like their actual day-to-day jobs. They didn't know what the end goal was.
Right. And it's something that happens today, even in other large scale projects, that it's the compartmentalization of information.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, it's kind of an ugly truth that gets sensationalized a lot, but I think we'll explore it later on in the show. The primary reason for this at this
yeah.
time was the, completely consuming paranoia on the part of the military of spying and espionage.
Yeah.
And not, you know, this wasn't some harebrained fantastical thing. This was a valid concern.
Yeah, as it turns out, it was so valid that it ended up not being paranoid enough. In Washington State, we have the third of the three sites. The project set up a headquarters in Hanford. And they created another boom town, another town that was specifically meant to help push the goals of the Manhattan Project. Hanford would become home to the water cooling pile facilities and the chemical separation plants, which were called the Queen Marys. And that only really makes sense if you see a picture of them. Because it looks almost like the shape of the stuff that's above ground
mm-hmm.
looks like it's in the shape of an old ocean liner.
Mm-hmm.
As if you had taken a Queen Mary ocean liner and buried it in the ground so only the very top is visible. That's why they were called that. So in the spring of 1943, Oppenheimer had another lab set up in Los Alamos, New Mexico. He began to suspect that it might take 3 times as much material, not 2 times as much as they had previously estimated, to make a working bomb. By the way, part of the reason why the atomic bombs ended up being so incredibly devastating is because they kept on thinking that they were going to need more and more fissionable material, and it turned out that some of the earlier estimations might have been a little more on the dot than they had worried about.
Mm-hmm.
1944, both the Y-12, which was that electromagnetic plant, and the K-25, that's the gaseous diffusion mm-hmm. plant, experienced problems. They were having issues all the way from 1943 to 1944. And project scientists decided to take a look at another method of isotope separation called thermal diffusion, which had previously been under consideration but kind of dismissed as being too slow and too poorly understood to rely upon as a reliable means of getting a weapon built. Because, you know, they're like, well, it might pan out in the long run, but in wartime consideration, it's not practical. At this point, they started to revisit it. And with both of those facilities having issues, there was a lot of incentive to look at it again because if the, either of the other two didn't pan out because of technical difficulties, because of skipping that pilot plant step, they needed to have a fallback plan. So Oppenheimer suggested to Groves that they build a thermal diffusion plant at Oak Ridge, and Groves agreed and co-located it with the power plant for the K-25, which the reason for that was the power plant would create steam, mm-hmm. which would turn turbines that generates electricity,
sure.
basic power plant right. design. So they decided, well, that steam is really hot. We can then use that as part of the thermal diffusion process to provide the heat. I mean, thermal meaning heat. Mm-hmm. This would be the best way of doing it. We wouldn't have to build another facility to generate steam. We could just co-locate it with this other one. So we've got all the science about the fissionable materials, but there's a whole other section we got to talk about, too.
Oh, yeah?
The actual development of the bomb itself.
Oh, yes. That is going to be an important part of this story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So you've got the science going on about how do we create this chain reaction. But mm-hmm. then you think, well, what about the actual device that's going to hold this material and initiate that chain reaction?
Right, yeah.
And there were some different approaches for that, too. So they started working on the ordnance aspects. That's essentially the physical manifestation of this bomb, like the physical parts. They called it the gadget. In order to do this, they were looking at multiple methods. One was this creating two subcritical masses of fissionable material that would come together so that, you know, when they're separated, everything's kosher. You don't have to worry about it blowing up.
Relatively inert and for our purposes.
And then bringing them together, that's what would allow the very rapid fission process to occur, releasing enormous amounts of energy in the process. Thus, you get the big boom.
Mm-hmm.
So they started looking into ways they could do this, and they had to figure out how to do it precisely at a high speed. And they had to make sure that whatever they did would not cause a pre-detonation, because that would be bad. You don't want your bomb going off before you planned on it going off. So one of the things they were looking at was the gun method, which was essentially firing a plug of fissionable material into a subcritical mass, turning it into critical.
Yeah.
So think of it as it's a bomb that has within it an actual gun. There's a barrel. It's got a plug of this stuff. When the trigger is pulled, essentially, it fires that plug into the subcritical mass and then starts the chain reaction. All this happens in a second. I mean, it's incredible how fast it happens.
But a lot of it, there are some things that can go wrong.
Yes, yeah. There are things that can go wrong. And one of those things is it may be that it doesn't start the reaction fast enough. So that was one of the deals. They wanted to test this theory both with U-235 and with plutonium approaches. And there was another approach that was looked at as well, not just using the gun, but what if you were to create an implosion? So an implosion would be you would create shock waves mm-hmm. that would then end up instigating this chain reaction. And the person who started looking at implosion tests first really was Seth H. Neddermeyer. And he was kind of left to his own devices to look into this. And he ended up looking at it along with John von Neumann, who's a Hungarian refugee who visited Los Alamos late in 1943. He was looking at various ways to create a reliable bomb as well. So you've got the nuclear physicists all working on the fuel and fissionable material side. And then you have the other like mechanical engineers looking at, well, how can we make this a practical weapon?
Right. Yeah.
So sort of like two parallel versions of research. Also, there was some friction between Neddermeyer and a Navy captain named William S. Deke Parsons. He was actually in charge of ordnance. So when you've got a guy who's working on one of the methods, the implosion method, and the guy who's in charge of it not getting along, that was an issue. And so you had to have kind of liaisons with that as well. So you did have some ego battles going on. People who thought that things needed to go a certain way and other folks who felt very strongly that that was not the appropriate direction. So a lot of drama going on behind the scenes as well, not just with the technology and the science, but with personalities, which is always kind of interesting. Then you had the Army Air Force involved there. You've got like so many different departments that there's departmental issues as well. Parsons Group was developing two bomb models by March 1944, and to he wanted to test these with B-29s. These are essentially the methodology without the actual bomb materials
right,
in
yeah,
them.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And they named them Thin Man, which was named after President Roosevelt. That used the plutonium gun design, so firing a plug of plutonium into fissionable material.
Highly purified plutonium.
Yes. And then you had Fat Man, which was named after Winston Churchill. That was an implosion prototype. So you had the implosion one needed a larger form factor, thus Fat Man.
Right.
And then you had Thin Man. You also had a smaller uranium gadget called Little Boy, which was using a uranium gun.
Yes.
So you had the plutonium gun and the uranium gun. The plutonium gun eventually was abandoned because it turned out that plutonium-239 could pick up a neutron and become plutonium-240 and increase the chances of pre-detonation, which we have already established is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, if we're going to use plutonium, we can't use the gun method. It would only really work with the implosion method. So the Thin Man variation on these bombs, that was abandoned. So you had Fat Man and Little Boy versions, and that was it. Because otherwise it was too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But this also meant that the approaches were requiring the timeline to extend a bit. They were not going to make that early 1945 deadline of a working bomb.
Right. And at this point in the war, the tide is turning.
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, on the Army Corps of Engineers side, you had Groves and Marshall meeting together and discussing what's happening. And their estimation was that by the time a bomb would be ready, they were being quoted that on August 1st, 1945 would be the earliest that a bomb would be available. They were pretty sure that by then Germany was going to have surrendered. The tides were turning enough where it looked like it was just Germany was on borrowed time. However, in the Pacific theater, Japan would likely fight to the very end. The Japanese culture was such that there was very little chance of Japan's government reconciling, at least in a way that the West found acceptable, because the West was going to demand that Japan dismantle its empirical system. And that was so deeply ingrained in Japanese culture, it was unlikely to happen until just catastrophic losses were experienced on Japan's
right.
side.
Also, the economies of all the countries involved at some point shifted greatly, as they do during times of war. But
yep.
the Japanese economy at the time was a war-powered economy. Like
yeah.
it was necessary to keep the cycle going.
Yeah. So pretty grim.
Yeah.
But it became more and more apparent to the Army Corps of Engineers that in fact, if they were able to produce a working bomb, the target was not going to be Germany. It was going to be Japan. They knew this in early 1945. They were pretty sure. By mid 1944, expenditures were around $100 million per month. And in late 1944 and early 1945, progress at Oak Ridge meant that the August 1st deadline actually started to look realistic. It didn't, you know, at first they were worried that even August 1st might be too aggressive. But the early problems that had been plaguing the facilities had largely been worked out. And now all the different lines of research were starting to be fruitful. So at this point, they weren't even saying which version is going to work. They were pretty sure there was going to be at least two. The plutonium implosion bomb looked like it was very promising, and the uranium gadget bomb, the gun method, looked like it was very promising. So then they started looking into how they were going to actually build these. Meanwhile, Hanford, up in Washington, their plutonium facilities had some problems early. There was an issue with what was called xenon poisoning.
Which was not for the employees.
No.
They weren't dying of xenon.
This was the nuclear fuel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the xenon, the process was producing xenon. And the problem was that the way the chain reaction works, if you remember from our previous episode, these radioactive elements, when they decay, give off fast-moving neutrons, mm-hmm. which can then trigger another particle to undergo fission, mm-hmm. and thus it ends up reducing fast-moving neutrons. And as long as it's producing more than one of those fast-moving neutrons, this becomes an expanding chain reaction.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you tell two friends and they tell two friends and they tell that sort of thing.
Perfect. Yeah.
So the problem was that xenon, which was being produced by this process, could accept neutrons so readily that it would end up preventing a chain reaction from happening. Essentially, like, come on over here, boys, we're good. And then, because the neutrons were being accepted by xenon, they were not triggering further fission.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they figured that out, they were able to take advantage of something DuPont had absolutely insisted upon when it agreed to build the facilities.
Mm-hmm.
They had designed the facility to allow for operation at greater power levels, which originally the scientists were saying, we don't, or actually is really the Army Corps of Engineers saying, we don't want this. It's too expensive. It's not necessary. We've been told that it should work at these lower power levels. And DuPont said, no, we're gonna have to insist. And as it turns out, that was the right decision.
Yep.
Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion of this Tech Stuff Classic episode right after we take this break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
A spirit of adventure lives inside of us. Nissan's SUVs have the capabilities to transform your spirit of adventure into actual rubber meets the road into the wild, true blue, real life adventure. You just need a Nissan and a plan. Or better yet, just a Nissan. You can hop into a Nissan Rogue and discover what comes next. Don't worry, the Nissan Rogue has your back. Class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Just climb in and go. No need to connect your phone. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the new 2024 Nissan Rogue. No matter where you roam, you'll stay connected to home. Life is one huge adventure, and every day is a little one. No matter if the ride you're on is big or small, a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada can elevate your adventure and push your limits to something new. Your next adventure is waiting for you. Get in a Nissan SUV and go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So by operating at the greater power levels, that overwhelmed the xenon. So in other words, it was generating neutrons at a rate so fast that the xenon was not going to be able to accept them at the rate they were coming out. So it was allowing that chain reaction to occur after all. So the Hanford facility began producing plutonium in significant amounts and sent the first shipment to Los Alamos in February 1945. So the plutonium gun method of bomb design did not work. The only way the plutonium was going to be useful is if they could prove the implosion method would work. So that's where the focus shifted at that point. They knew the gun design was a bust, so they started looking significantly into implosion. So by late 1944, they were pretty sure that the uranium gun method was viable. So that was going to be the little boy version the bomb. They froze that design, meaning they said, all right, this is definitely what we are going to build. They froze it in February 1945. Plutonium, their work with that was obviously taking a little longer. They knew the gun design wasn't going to work. But once they figured out the implosion design, that got approved in March, and they scheduled a test for the 4th of July. Biggest fireworks you'd ever see.
Right. Yes.
However, they actually moved it back to July 16th because of weather, actually, and they named it the Trinity Test, and it happened at 5:30 in the morning. So, interesting thing, the uranium gun method was so certain, they didn't test it. They never tested the bomb before they used it. But the plutonium method, they weren't sure. So they build this plutonium bomb, the implosion-based bomb, at 5:30 in the morning on July 16th, they fire it. They used a firing tower to hold the bomb and to kind of approximate where the bomb would be before it detonated. Because detonate before they hit the ground.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like there's a tip on the bomb that hits the ground. They're programmed to get to a certain elevation, built to get to a certain elevation, and then explode above the ground because it maximizes the damage.
Yeah. This, by the way, is also where our conversation is going to get pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Because we're now talking about actual physical damage and the loss of human life. So while we were maybe a little cavalier, I don't know even if cavalier is the right word, but we were playful at points. This is where this show is really going to get serious because we're talking about real human beings. So this test was phenomenally impressive and successful from a weaponization point of view. It vaporized the firing tower. Mm-hmm. It turned asphalt into sand, and it turned sand into glass. The explosion knocked over a 200-ton steel container that was a half mile from ground zero. The steel container had been built and designed and put down as part of the test, but they didn't intend to actually use it on the July 16th test. It was literally just standing where they had left it.
A half mile away.
And it knocked it over. The explosion was bright enough to cause temporary blindness in observers, even those who were wearing goggles with smoked glass lenses. They knew it was going to be bright. They had no idea how bright it was going to be, and some of them lost their vision for a while. Glass would shatter in houses 125 miles from the explosion point. And it was equivalent to 15,000 to 20,000 tons of TNT. They had estimated it would be about equivalent to 5,000 tons.
And this goes back to the earlier statements. This is also, by the way, the day that Oppenheimer creeps out everyone.
Yeah. But,
and the
yes. We say, whoops. Instead of whoops, he says, I
am become death.
Death, destroyer of worlds.
Yeah. And just briefly on that, the reason that he said that, there's a great quotation from him here. says, "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, 'Now I'm become death, the destroyer of worlds.' I suppose we all thought that one way or another." You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they did, but this, in this day, you know, you have to think about how you would feel 125 miles away.
Yeah.
This thing blows up, and I don't know if blame is the right word, but because they kept upping the amount they thought they needed.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
And
those people who witnessed the detonation and participated in it were very lucky to survive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you think about this, like, you know, they didn't have a full understanding of what the long-term effects were going to be of this. Not just, you know, the initial effects are devastating enough, but the long-term effects continue to end up, you know, causing damage and killing years after the initial explosion. We'll get into some figures a little bit. So I think this is also one of those points where there's that moment of realization that the thing you've been working so hard, the thing that previously had just been theory, that you had based it upon observations of the energy that was released in these nuclear reactions, something that you knew was possible but had not actually seen for yourself, now is reality. It is no longer abstract thought. It is no longer the realm of calculations on a sheet of paper. Now it's real. And that's got to be a heavy, heavy moment.
Especially considering what this is.
Yeah, especially when you consider what the intended purpose is. On April 12, 1945, President Roosevelt dies, and Vice President Harry S. Truman is sworn in as president. Here's how secret the Manhattan Project was. Despite the fact that it employed around 130,000 people at one time or another, Truman didn't know about it.
It also detonated a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And the vice president didn't know about it.
He didn't know about it. No, at this point in April, they hadn't detonated.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's July.
So, but in April, they hadn't happened yet. But Truman, they were well on their way to the test.
Mm-hmm.
Truman had no idea. He was briefed on it as part of becoming president during war, which is, you know, a pretty tough gig, no matter how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But Truman understood the relevance of the project, and he supported it. You know, plus it's pretty late in the game. They had built the thing pretty much. They just needed to test it at that point. So on the political side, Germany had surrendered, and it was clear that Japan was going to lose the conflict, but was probably going to fight until the very end. So it was going to require a massive invasion of Japan using, you know, a coordinated effort with the Allied forces in order to make it happen. No telling how many people would die on both sides of that. And it was going to be, it was going to extend the war even further. And so there was a very serious discussion about what do we do? Do we go forward with invasion plans, or do we actually use this weapon we have designed? Now, the U.S. informed Churchill of the success of the test.
Yeah.
And Churchill was all for it.
Until he found out it was nicknamed Fat Boy.
Fat Man.
Fat Man, sorry.
Yeah, Fat Man named after him. I don't know if he ever, I don't know when he got the memo on that part, but he was totally on board. Truman told Stalin, he had been told by his advisors, "Hey, don't tell Stalin. Stalin's kind of a bad guy. You don't want to let him know about this ahead of time." But Truman felt that it was necessary to preserve the uneasy peace between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Right.
So he told Stalin of the development of the weapon and told Stalin without the presence of an interpreter. It's just Truman and Stalin. And Stalin was very composed. And it turns out the reason he was composed was because he already knew about it. He already knew about it because despite the paranoia.
Yep.
There was a Soviet spy amongst the Brits who were working alongside the Americans on the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll talk a little bit about him in a second. But the U.S. wanted unconditional surrender of Japan, the dismantling of the imperial system, and Japan wanted to surrender based on intercepted messages between Tokyo and Moscow, but right. not under the conditions that the Americans were demanding.
Right. Japan, I believe, still wanted to maintain some of the territory that it had acquired.
And they didn't want to abandon the empire approach of their government. Like that was a big deal. And the United States was like, no, your empire, the imperial method has to go.
Yeah.
It can't. We want democracy. We want a different system of government rather than what you've been using.
Disbanded.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, it was a tall order, and Japan was not, like, the Japanese government was not in a position that could easily capitulate to those demands.
Right, right.
So things are moving ahead. And on August 6, 1945, the Enola Gay, a B-29 bomber piloted by Colonel Paul Tibbets, released a 9,700-pound uranium gun bomb called Little Boy. This is the one that had never been tested. They knew they were confident it would work, but they had never actually tested this bomb. And it was released at approximately 8:15 a.m., 31,000 feet above Hiroshima, Japan, and 43 seconds later it detonated. At that point, it was at an altitude of 1,900 feet above the city. And the initial explosion killed 70,000 people.
More or less instantly.
Yeah. This is where you hear about people's shadows being burned into the walls behind them because of the intense energy that was released by this bomb. By 1950, the death count would be closer to 200,000. So that 70,000, that was initial where, again, instantaneous, not even a moment to think. It's just over. But another 130,000 would die due to radiation sickness. So an agonizing fate for so many. Nearly all the buildings in a 5-square-mile radius were either leveled completely or just severely damaged to the point where there was no chance of using them again. Mm-hmm. They would need to be taken down. Truman announced the Hiroshima raid that evening to the American public, which was the first time that the United States revealed to the general public that they had been working on an atomic weapon. This was the first time the Manhattan Project had been unveiled in a sense that it existed, right? They didn't go into any details about how much work had gone into it or what had happened, but that this was the first time. So again, 130,000 people had worked on it. Many of those people, this was the first time they found out what their work was, what the result was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't know necessarily. There were very few of that 130,000 who actually knew what the purpose of the Manhattan Project really was, which is phenomenal. It's hard in hindsight. It's hard for us to imagine that. I'm sure at the time it was a job. You know, you were working on science.
Yeah. And communication worked differently because this was not
pre-internet.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So the United States, and in the wake of this, calls for Japan's surrender according to the earlier terms. Japan did not immediately respond, which then led to the August 9th bombing of Nagasaki. This was the plutonium implosion method. This was the one that they had tested previously. This was called Fat Man, and it was carried by a plane named Box Car. B-O-C-K, not B-O-X.
Mm-hmm.
And Nagasaki was actually the secondary target. The primary target was the Kokura Arsenal, which would have been more of a military target than Nagasaki was. But weather prevented the pilot, Charles Sweeney, from flying over it. He felt that there was too low of a chance that he would be able to drop the bomb on the intended target, so he swapped out to his secondary target, which was Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
It was dropped at an altitude of 29,000 feet and detonated 1,650 feet above Nagasaki at 11:01 a.m. and exploded with a force of 21,000 tons of TNT. Now, it killed 40,000 people and injured another 60,000 on that initial explosion. And the eventual death toll was calculated at around 140,000, largely because Nagasaki did not have the same population density as Hiroshima. It wasn't that this was a less devastating bomb. It was that due to the geography, it affected fewer people.
So in the space of just a few days,
yeah,
Japan lost 340,000 lives.
Ultimately would lose 340,000.
Ultimately, you're right. Yeah. After
the initial would be closer to 110,000.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. In two bombings. Mm-hmm. Devastating. Absolutely devastating. The Manhattan Project itself would continue, because while it had built these bombs specifically for the purpose of bringing World War II to an end, the research was going to continue on, and it would end officially in 1947 and hand over the research into atomic weaponry to a new group, the Atomic Energy Commission, which we talked about extensively when we covered Area 51.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Atomic Energy Commission was important during the establishment of Area 51. So I mentioned that there had been a spy who reported to the Soviet Union. That would be Klaus Fuchs, who was part of the British contingent of scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project. It was not discovered until 1949 that he was actually a Soviet agent. So throughout the entirety of the Manhattan Project, all the way to the point where it was over, he was feeding information to the Soviet Union. He was caught and convicted of espionage and was eventually released in 1959. He then moved to what was then East Germany. Kids, if you don't know that there was an East Germany, there was for a while. You need to look that up. He eventually provided information that helped China develop its first atomic bomb.
Right. Yeah. So you may have heard stories recently, or in the past few years, about a scientist named A.Q. Khan continually linked to other countries acquiring nuclear weaponry or knowledge of the atomic process. This is Klaus Fuchs is like the original version of that, and did quite a bit to propagate this technology. Also, the Manhattan Project, on balance, is fairly lucky that he's the kind of spy he was, a spy sent to feed information rather than to stymie the progress. So he made a contribution.
The goal of ending World War II was shared, obviously, by both Stalin and the United States. But obviously, Stalin also had a very strong interest in gaining that information for on behalf of Soviet Union, so that the United States would not have the upper hand for very long in what would then become the Cold War.
Yeah.
Another important person that we didn't really mention, I mean, there's so many, there are tons. The list of names connected to the Manhattan Project is incredibly long, 130,000 as it turns out. But another important person on the physics side was Edward Teller, a theoretical physicist. He was the one who was really pushing for the development of the hydrogen bomb. In fact, he has been referred to as the father of the hydrogen bomb, a name he did not like. They called it the super bomb during the Manhattan Project, and eventually it would be developed. Not used, but developed and tested. So that is the story of the Manhattan Project, from the beginning all the way to the development and deployment of the two atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan.
Yeah, and we touched on a lot of things that are stories in themselves. The USSR's program, I think Stalin learned of the U.S. program, or the U.S. intentions in 1940, which and then there's this story that I think you mentioned in part one, about what happens to the scientists who are held consensually or not in the German program.
Yeah.
And, you know, Operation Paperclip, which again, more rocketry.
Yeah.
That's more rocketry on the U.S. side. But the USSR forcibly abducted some scientists from the German program. Very strange time.
There's tons of stuff we could talk about. And in fact, I'm sure stuff they don't want you to know has covered quite a bit of this material too.
We touched on some of it.
One or two.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend you go check out that show just in general, but especially if you want to learn more about, you know, the tactics that were employed. This was, I mean, there are no games higher stakes than this, right? This is incredibly grim stuff when you boil it down to what's actually the end goal and what is happening. And as a result, there are nations and people who will, you know, there's no limit to what they will the tactics they will employ to achieve the goal, because the goal, the stakes are so high. And sometimes that leads to stories of heroism, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it leads to stories of, ooh, that is dirty, underhanded stuff, you know, that uprooting people, whether they are quote unquote on the wrong side or not, and then forcing them to work on your behalf.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, there were people who were more than willing to do that because to them, the science was what was important.
Mm-hmm.
They were,
that was their ultimate moral compass was, can I work on the science?
Yeah. And it wasn't so much who is the person, like I'm not the one who decides who this gets used on. I'm the one who figures out whether or not it works.
Yeah.
It's an odd story, and there's so many of them, but on all sides.
Could I ask you? And tell me if this is too. Tell me if this is too much of a heavy or speculative thing.
What's that?
Do you think the world is a better place with this technology? It's a rough one. I quarrel with it myself sometimes.
I think nuclear power certainly has some very important applications, some of which are incredibly beneficial to humanity, even with the problematic nuclear fuel and nuclear waste issues.
Sure.
So on that side, I think that it was incredibly important and beneficial. From a weaponry side, I think it just caused enormous amounts of harm, beyond the obvious of the people who lost their lives as a result of the bombs being dropped. There are stories of people who may have developed cancer just from working on the projects.
Right. Yeah.
Whether or not that's actually the cause, it's impossible to say because there are just too many vectors to take into account.
Sure.
But it seems like it's a likely source, at least for some of the cases, if not many of them. I mean, the Cold War was awful.
Yeah.
I mean, it led to the space race, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the world changing or civilization changing technology that we have today comes from times of conflict.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we would not be where we are today without that conflict, but I don't necessarily think that that's put us in a great place. I mean, there are current conflicts in the world, cold and otherwise, that the presence of nuclear weapons have made far more complex and higher stakes than would otherwise exist. And I'm not a big fan of that. So,
yeah.
I mean, and ultimately, I do believe that the Allied powers would have won World War II without the use of atomic weapons.
Next question, yeah.
It would have happened.
Yeah.
The question is, how long would it have taken, and how much more would Japan have... Would Japan have suffered more due to the nature of the war than it did from the bombs? That's a question that's impossible to answer, because there's no way of knowing how it would have turned out otherwise.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you start to wonder if perhaps the bombing of Japan was not only to force Japan to capitulate to the United States demands and the Allied demands of surrender, but also perhaps a demonstration of the United States' superiority in weaponry to say, hey, everybody in the world, pay attention, because this is what we can do now.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to think that that was, if a part... the smallest of parts, but something deep inside me worries about that.
And that wraps up part two of our discussion about the Manhattan Project, Tech Stuff Takes Manhattan. Thanks to Ben Bolin for joining the show way back in 2015. You're a real mensch, or at least you were 7 years ago. I'm sure you still are. I mean, we're arch nemeses now, because I'm his alter ego villain character quizster on Ridiculous History. So I'll have to have him back on the show so that he can get his licks in, since I'm always on his shows giving him grief. If you have suggestions for topics we should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, please reach out. The best way to do that is on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. We all can't help but wonder what adventure lies just over the next ridge. A Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada will take you there. If you're taking on your adventure in a new 2024 Nissan Rogue, class-exclusive Google built-in is your always-updating assistant to call on for almost anything. Google Assistant, Google Maps, and Google Play Store are built right into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue. Nissan's SUV has the capabilities to take you where you want to go. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco-Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, it's Andy, Mike, and Jason of the Fantasy Footballers Podcast here, and we're inviting you to join us live on NFL Plus following the first round of the NFL draft. Look, fantasy football, let's be honest, gentlemen, it kind of rules the world.
That's right, and we will be live with in-the-moment fantasy football reactions to all the first-round selections and all the craziest surprises. We never can predict what's going to happen on that first day of the NFL draft.
Lots of elite talent at the skill positions that will have a big impact on fantasy football this year. Are we going to get three wide receivers in the top 10? Are we going to break the record for the most wide receivers in the first round? Is there going to be a running back? I don't know.
And there's a lot of teams like the Chiefs, the Bills. We're really excited about their quarterback. Do they add a wide receiver? What are some of those best landing spots?
The Fantasy Footballers Draft Special will air exclusively on NFL Plus on Thursday, April 25th, following the conclusion of the first round of the draft. Go to plus.nfl.com to sign up today. Terms and conditions apply.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.